Gut. So, with only 10 minutes delay, because of the wrong microphone and other irritations, and even the man in the back. Ooh. I love it. 5 out of 150, so that's a percentage of 3%, I don't know. That's okay. So, you regret waking up. That's very motivating. Cool. Good. So you will regret waking up, I dare. Good. Today we're going to talk about task number 4 for the games engineering students. Hi there, and well, let's start right away. Good. So the main aspect of the 4th assignment, well, I would use the terms task or assignment interchangeably. The main content will be social signal processing. So unfortunately, we're not yet there in the lecture, but I hope to give you an introduction right away. So there are basically 2 tasks, and they're basically very easy. At least that's what I think. And so as with assignment number 3, compared to assignment number 2, these should be rather small assignments, yeah, compared. So, and still, we got 3 weeks for this. And if time should not suffice, we can certainly give another week if that's necessary, right? Cool. So, 2 tasks, and the first task will be the detection, or will be dealing with the detection of social situations on the basis of interaction geometry, and I will tell you in a minute what I mean by this. So basically what you're supposed to do is implement a Gaussian mixture model and play around with some other classifiers from the Weka toolkit, right? And the second task will be about face recognition. And we'll be using a technique that's comparatively old. It's called eigenfaces. It's basically principal component analysis and K and N classifiers in that case, right? So that's rather simple. And the third task is more or less brief, but I want you to develop ideas with respect to how we can apply social signal processing and these 2 things that we talk about in particular for our goal to design better games, more entertaining games, or more interesting games, right? And we'll be using a creativity support software that has been developed at our chair. And the only thing that you need to do is to do a guided brainstorming session together and document it, right? Cool. So let's start with task number 1, interaction geometry and Gaussian mixture models. Okay. So what is social signal processing about? Okay. So before we talk about this, what is social signal processing? We need to talk about what is a social signal, right? And we will talk about this in more depth in the coming lecture, but informally, every expression of your body, your face, your voice, your behavior, your gestures, and everything that's detectable by other humans is a social signal. That part on being detectable by other humans is something that is debatable, right? So you can leave that out and also include unconscious social signals. So everything that you as a person reveal and that has to do with social interaction can be called a social signal. These things are have smaller units that they're made up of. And one example is facial expressions. You all know these nice pictograms, and you know that this is a simple face, and you can change that from being angry to being sad, yeah, just by changing the angle of the eyebrows. And that's also something that is realized in our face. So there are so-called action units. These are the basic units of movement that you can make with your facial muscles and that have a social signal value. Same is true for voice prosody. And what is also true is that it's true for body language, right? And body language is the thing that we are going to exploit, right? So scientifically, we're in the field of social networking. That's something we defined in the subfield of mobile social networking. And our central notion here was social context, right? And mobile social networking, why? Because for being able to detect social signals, we need an array of sensors, right? And basically, we want to regard sensors that you carry along, right? So basically, the stuff that's in your mobile phone, right? And you know that there's a lot of sensors in there, a microphone, a gyroscope, and others that allow you to measure acceleration and position in space, right? And with the help of such sensors, you're also able to measure interaction geometry, basically. So that's why we're in the field of mobile social networking, meaning that we want to use mobile context, and in that case, mobile social context. So that's a bit in contrast to what we've been doing throughout the semester. Throughout the semester, we've been concentrating on social networks, and we know these are long-term social contexts that are more, well, desktop-oriented in a way, right? So they're not that dynamic. They don't change that often. So we can stay away from or not include the mobile context in that case. However, here we will. And one special case of social context, mobile social context, are models of social situations, right? So what is a social situation? Very briefly, we can understand by a social situation a co-located social interaction where all the participating persons have full mutual awareness about their interaction, right? So currently in this lecture hall, we're having a social situation, right? So you five heroes that are here in the morning, you all know that you're in a lecture, right? And I know that you know that I know that you know you're in a lecture, right? Furthermore, so this social situation is guided by a number of social laws and rules, right? So as you know, I'm easily distracted, so you keep quiet at the moment. And you have your reasons why, for example, you seated yourself in the way you do, right? So that's your place that you always take in the back, because I don't know, maybe you can view the slides a bit better, or you don't want to be talked at directly. I don't know. So there's a lot of reasons why you position yourselves in that social space, right? And in that social space, there's a lot of forces that act upon us. For example, the furniture, right? So these chairs and all that kind of exert some forces. So we cannot arrange ourselves freely. If this were an even space and I were to give you the presentation with a smaller beamer, you'd potentially come closer. And that's not only because of vision or sound, that's also because of social conventions, right? So that's how it is. However, in a lecture hall, we all know that you're free to sit wherever you want, so there is no convention telling you it's impolite to do so, right? And we can tell a lot of things about these social situations. So there is a sociological group structure within there. There were several roles. There is a force structure. There is a power structure. So who's in charge in such a group? Who talks a lot? Who's more quiet? And these things, right? And there is even gender issues going on there, which I may comment on in a few seconds, right? So a very simplified model would just restrict itself to denoting the set of participating persons, right? And the respective spatiotemporal reference frame that the situation is in. So where in space and time does that situation occur, right? Where, what are the boundaries? So for example, our social situation will last until 9:45, presumably some minutes longer. And, well, that's the spatial reference here in that lecture hall. Okay. So that's basically what we're after. And, the scenario that we're in could also be described as a scenario of decentralized mobile social networking, where each of you has a personal social net, mobile social networking agent, right? So that could also be a small piece of software running on your mobile, using the sensors and, well, deciding upon which services you want to access, which ubiquitous computing services, and especially that's a good setting for us to kind of have a playground in which we can deal with these social situation detection algorithms. So basically, each of these three persons has a mobile, and on the mobile there is an agent running, and the agents can, in principle, communicate with respect to, is my owner in a social situation or not, and what is the, what are the ideas of the other persons, and so on and so on, right? The question is, what can we use that for, right? So naturally, as always, I have to emphasize that this is very privacy sensitive, of course, and the, well, traditional protagonists of that field of science, for example, Alex Pentland from MIT that I already mentioned a few times, they're a bit optimistic, right? So they say, good, well, certainly there is a privacy issue with all these data, with all these intimate data, with all these situational data, but there's a lot of services that we can establish that are of high value for the people. Right. And well, in that case, if you knew all your social situations, I'm not convinced of that. Right. I do that type of research, but I'm not truly convinced that the usefulness of the services will outweigh the privacy issues. Right. So I think that big data in the personal space is a considerable danger we need to be aware of. And up to the present time, there is no true killer service that one would say, well, this justifies everything, okay? What you could think of is, for example, advanced privacy rules or mechanisms that would allow you to state, well, I give everyone access to certain data that is in a social situation with me. For example, if you're having a booth at a fair, right, and you're exhibiting something, you can say, I want to give my, well, private catalog with more details to those customers that at least were, kind of talking to me at the booth and not just passing by, right? The passing by thing you could realize with location-based privacy rules, but the other ones would need the agent to know which social situations you were in, right? Or other things that we thought of was mobile social life logging retrieval issues, right? So, you know, a few years ago, Microsoft was very much geared towards personal life logging, since your visual and audiovisual data of your complete life fits on a disc, basically, right? And for some persons, it's tempting, interesting to have a personal diary of everything. Now, the problem with these diaries is that they are hard to browse and hard to retrieve, right? If you say, well, could you replay the situation where I was with that tall guy and the girl there over there? I mean, that's certainly not a question that a computer could answer. But if you knew your social situations, you could kind of index these multimedia streams with stuff like that. However, as I said, no killer application. However, it's interesting to nevertheless think about the chances and limits and chances of detecting these things, right? Good. So, as I said, it's a subfield of social signal processing. So how would you do that, right? How would you detect a social situation? How would you instantiate a model of a social situation in terms of knowing who's with you, interacting with you, and what the respective spatial and temporal reference or boundaries are, okay? So one technique could be to use microphones as sensors, right? Microphones would deliver you audio signals. With audio signals, you could do speaker diarization. So you could kind of partition the audio stream into contributions from each speaker, right? And with that, you can kind of do reasoning about turn-taking patterns, for example, right? So if you have three persons, like person one, two, three, and if that's time, right, you would have turns when every person speaks, right? So at this, so there is person one and two and three. So three is a rather modest person. So three is quiet all the time. But here she says, no, now I want to talk and the others listen, right? So that's an ordered turn-taking pattern. Right. And if you include other persons that are not in that social situation, for example, person zero and whatever person one half, right, they might have their own conversation, which is more heated, right, with lots of overlaps and small turns. And as you can see, they're not kind of coordinated with these, right? So for a classifier, it's possible to say, well, it's very probable that these are in a social situation and these, right? But for example, person one half is not in a social situation with person two, right? Because there's just no coordination of the turns. That kind of works reasonably. To be honest, I wouldn't bet my money on that, right? We did some experiments with that, rather extensive experiments, but, well, you need rather ideal conditions. Reasons for that is that speaker diarization is a very hard problem, yeah? Especially if you only have one audio stream. It's okay if you just want to filter out your own voice with your own device, right? But in basically everybody that wants to participate in these services needs to have an agent or a mobile on its own, right? On his or her own. Trying to do speaker diarization with one audio stream and N speakers is a problem that's too hard, right? So it's not solvable as far as we know. And there's things like background noise and attenuation by the fact that I wear my mobile here in that pocket and not freely attached to my chest and so on. Rather hard. So second, way to do it is you could use the array of sensors in your mobile device to measure relative body orientations and relative body distances or interpersonal distances, right? So that would be a rough schema of interaction geometry. And we will see examples why this follows regular patterns. And that would allow you to decide, at least for each pair, whether this pair of persons is currently socially interacting. Okay? And so that's basically social situation detection. If you want to understand more about social situations, you could as well use these interpersonal geometry, right? Because you know that if persons are closer to each other, they're more intimate with each other than compared to whether they stand a bit more apart. But you could do the same with the audio stuff via, for example, emotion detection. And emotion detection or emotional computing is also something that has already a long tradition. Also protagonists from the MIT Media Lab, Rosalind Picard, she was an electrical engineer. She's professor at MIT and she's one of the founders of that field, right? And the idea basically is, that your emotional state is rather well reflected in your voice prosody, right? So if I talk like this, you know that it's something different than if I talk like this. Okay. So there's things that you encode in your voice and you can measure these things and then you can, for example, make models of the states of minds of the persons, but that's not what we want, right? Now, speaking of interpersonal distances, something that we will get in the lecture in more detail, there were several sociopsychologists in the 1950s until 1970s that kind of heavily researched how persons would establish their distances. And you know that it's quite easy to disturb people, yeah? Because already here you would ask yourself, what is he doing? What is he doing? Why is he coming so near? And it's here, that's the point where things become strange. And that's the point where things become really, really strange. Yeah. So, you know, it's for every person. Yeah. So I can do the same experiment with you. Yeah. And there is an intimate zone, clearly, right? Even for you in the back, you would recognize that there is some change in the interaction geometry that has social significance, right? So you really feel that here in your temple. There's a bustling and hustling if people come near like this. So there was a sociopsychologist called Hall that distinguished four zones. And the innermost zone is the intimate zone. Right, that you would only allow, for example, your partner or a doctor or whatever person in that's very intimate or that's very close to you or where the situation would require that, right? Then there is the friendship zone where you would like invite your friends. There's the socio-consultative zone. This is the zone where you would, for example, do communication with a clerk at an office or one of your teachers. And there is this last zone, which is basically open space for the public, right? And there is other theories, for example, about F formations that also make statements about the angles, right? So you can imagine that if you have three persons interacting in a free space and they would stand and communicate, naturally you would have something like this, more or less something like this, right? Such a triangle. And it's clear if there are four persons, they would form something like a square and so on, right? So the angles also play a distinctive role. There's much more than these two quantities, right? So, for example, the gestures are something that's very expressive. There's a large field about gesture recognition in computer vision, right? There are people that kind of try to compute wireframe images of your limbs just from pixel images. And you know that, for example, with a Kinect, you can easily derive these wireframe things with computer vision, right? And once you have the wireframes, so that's basically the angles of your limbs, That's a very restricted set of features that you could use, or time series of that features that you could use for gesture detection, right? But that's not what we want to do, okay? So, and other influences are, as I said, the architectural environment, culture, age, self-esteem, disabilities, and so on. So, for example, age, we recently made an experiment kind of trying to investigate whether our algorithmic methods are able to cope with the gender differences of persons, right? Because in a mixed gender social situation, distances and angles will be different compared to a pure gender system, right? So, for example, if two male persons would stand like this, for two males, this is rather confrontative, right? There's aggression in the air in most cases. So if two males would stand around, they would normally form some open angle while they talk, right? But that's also dependent on the actual issue that they discuss. If they discuss something very serious, they might even position themselves in that way without being aggressive, okay? But if that were a female, right, and if this were a male, things would be different, right? So there would be a larger distance that would be automatically established if they don't know each other for obvious reasons, complicated reasons. But so as we see, these things influence that. Culture, it's clear that there are more inclusive cultures and there are more cultures that prefer a higher, larger distance and so on and so on. Good. So possible research questions that we follow, what are general quantitative models for kind of classifying, dealing, modeling with human social interaction, geometry? Things that we also investigated in the past was how would we use these models to actually detect social situations. That would involve a bit of a higher order reasoning. So if you have a binary model, how would you be able to generalize this to an N-ary model? Here we used subjective logic-based frameworks and so on. And last but not least, uses of these models. And the first thing before you can actually use the data is you must make up your mind about how to measure interpersonal distance and body angles with mobile devices, right? So as for distances, you can do so by using, for example, ultrasound sensors. You can use like normal microphones and crosstalk assessments, right? Because if you have one person that's here, right, and has his or her device here, and the other one is here, right? Okay, good. He's very happy. And so naturally, if this person talks, the person's voice will be on both devices, yeah, but with a little running difference, because here we would have to take the longer distance, right, compared to here. And if you synchronize the devices properly, which is hard, then you can do the triangulation with a rough error of, I don't know, 10, 15 centimeters. Same you can do with direct measurements if you use ultrasound, for example. And the angles, it's rather simple with linear regression using all the geometric sensors that are in there. You can do that with a error of about 10 degrees, right? So these things are accessible. Maybe not now, because obviously no iPhone contains ultrasound sensors, but maybe in the future. Good. And what we did in terms of the lab course was we conducted an experiment where we made persons interact. We had certain stimuli. They were supposed to discuss certain things, and they wore infrared sensor tags, right? And at Professor Nawab's chair, there is a system installed that consists of several infrared cameras, and that can properly detect these beacons, right? Shouldn't call them beacons. It's more like tags or targets, since they're not sending out actively. They just are composed of reflective spheres that are arranged in known configurations. So 3D things that have certain size with certain things sticking out. So the cameras can then infer the precise position of that tag in space. Position and angle, yeah? Because the tags themselves are 3D arrangements of spheres. And we put these things on the people's shoulders. So what this gave us was the proper ground truth, right? So for each person and each moment in time, we knew their position and their angle, and then we were able to easily detect the pairwise interpersonal distance between any two pair of persons in the room and the interpersonal angles of any pair of persons in the room, just via projection and simple geometry calculations, right? So in the end, what we have is for each pair of persons, maybe I should put this on, right? So if here you see five persons from above, right? And so there are 5/2 pairs in that configuration, yeah? So general. And the first three persons are in a social situation, and the second three. And these are marked with green edges, whereas the pairs that are marked with red edges are not in a social situation, right? So for each pair, you have these angles, delta, theta, yeah? So the upper body angles. Should have said that, right? So what I mean is the orientation of the torso with respect to angles, right? And so naturally there are other angles, but if you project down these orientations on the XY plane, you get the angle of your orientation, and that's what matters, right? So because what we assumed was that the head orientation would be a Gaussian distribution around the upper body orientation, right? So nobody would give a lecture like that, yeah? But what I do is I would position myself in front of you and maybe change the orientation of the head subtly. But that we assume to be Gaussian distributed so that we can kind of neglect that, okay? So the idea is to decide for each pair of persons what is the probability that they are currently socially interacting given their distances and given their angles. Okay? That's the task, basically, that we're faced with. And once you have that probability for each pair, you're having a weighted graph, and in that weighted graph, you can do graph clustering. And the graph clustering would then give you the actual annery social situations. So in our experiment, we had about, 300,000 pairs of persons in a social situation, and roughly, 400,000 pairs of measurements, I should say, corresponding to persons not to pairs of persons not being in a social situation, right? So imagine this experiment took half an hour, roughly, and we measured these things at each half a second, right? So that for each pair of persons, that gives 60 seconds, 60 measurements. No, idiot. 100 times, 120 times 30, right? So roughly 3,000 measurements for each pair, right? And in that experiment, we had 9 persons, right? So there are 9/2 pairs. And these for each of these pairs, we have roughly 3,000 of these two real numbers measurements, okay? And we annotated the experiment, so for each of the respective pairs and each moment in time, We know whether that person is in a social situation or that pair of person is in a social situation or not, right? So we know the ground truth. And what we do now is we construct a classifier and then try to assess this probability. So the set of pairs of persons being in a social situation, no, that's not right. The set of delta theta, delta d pairs of measurements corresponding to a pair of persons being in a social situation, we would call S plus, and the set of pairs of measurements, delta theta, delta d, corresponding to pairs of persons being not in a social situation is called S minus. Okay? And, well, that's what we did. And the question is, what would that look like? Okay? So, if you plot all the measurements that you have, not regarding, or, yeah, well, if you regard the actual class, yeah? So let's start with S plus. So S plus contains only pairs of delta D, delta theta values that correspond to pairs of persons in a social situation. And what does that look like, right? So if you plot them all in one diagram, so the x-axis is delta theta, the y-axis is delta d, you would get an image that looks like this, right? And what we can see is, for example, here this gap is just the intimate zone. So there are no measurements in the gap. So even pairs of persons that do interact do respect their respective intimate zones. Okay, that's one reading out there. There is also a slight number which cannot be seen here in that red plot, where persons stand behind other persons. Right. So you might wonder. Why we have negative distances. So the negative distances are just a way to respect the polar angle in a pragmatic way, right? So if you have a situation like this, yeah, we would say that this person has a positive distance to that person and that person has a positive distance to the other one, right? If you turn this person around, yeah, then they would have a negative distance, right? So this person has a negative distance to this, but this has a positive distance to that, right? Just regarding the polar angle that they take. So that's why we're also having negative distances. And that means that even for a pair socially interacting, we can have a slight negative angles. And that's, for example, if you have something like this, right? So there's two persons in a social situation and a third one comes in and approaches these, right? And hi guys, I want to talk to you. So these are already in a social situation, but technically, the distance here would be negative, right? But these are very few measurements, as we can see here in the heat plot, just the same coded, encoded with a heat plot style diagram. And what we see is that the typical arrangement is that persons stand in this 80 centimeter distance, acting at about angles of 45 degrees, right? So that's very typical for this positive set, right? So that's because in these F formations, this angle here, right, is typically about pi half or minus pi half, and that corresponds to 45 degrees, right? And if you plot only delta d and integrate over delta theta, you would get this image, right? So there are few persons standing in the back, a lot of persons standing here in this friendship zone area, and so on. And if you only plot the angles, you would see that maximum here at pi half. Okay. If you plot the same thing for persons not interacting, you would see that we have a very broad distribution here. Yeah. So no clear maxima here. Still, we have the intimate zone. Okay. But there is no systematic correspondence here. Yeah, so these things are rather flat, and here we would have lumps, and the backward-oriented things are much more prominent than as before, right? Because clearly, if you have a situation like that, where here you would have two persons, and here you would have another two persons, right? Then clearly, those two, or the distance from that person to that, is negative. Yeah, so that's way more typical for pairs of persons not being in a social situation, right? Now, and that's this thing as a 3D plot. So for the social situation, for the pairs of measurements of pairs of persons in a social situation, we have this and this rather flat distribution for the case that pairs of measurements of pairs of persons not being in a social situation, right? And what we did then was to train Gaussian mixture models for each of the two cases, okay? So Gaussian mixture models we had in the lecture as means for clustering, right? If you remember. So if you have, let's say, things that have two features, whatever these two features are, x1 and x2, and you have measurements, yeah? Measurements that look like this, yeah? What we did when we used Gaussian mixture models for clustering was we guessed the number of clusters, right? And then we fitted the Gaussian mixture models with expectation maximization. So in the end, maybe we'd have one Gaussian here representing this cluster and one Gaussian here representing the other cluster, right? So this is Gaussian mixture models for clustering. And in essence, what we had was these Gaussians, or the sum of the respective Gaussians, the Gaussian mixture model, right, would give us the probability of X, yeah, given theta was sum over K from 1 to K pi K, and that's these Gaussians mu K sigma K, yeah? That's the Gaussian mixture model, okay? But that's for clustering. For classification, we would use the Gaussian mixture models in a different way. Oh, thanks for not having a means of... there it is. Okay. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Good. So for Gaussian mixture models, we use them in a generative classifier way. So for each class, we would now compute a Gaussian mixture model. Okay, so we would have the following situation. Now we would have delta theta, delta d, yeah, for example, and we would still have measurements, right, that look like this. Okay, let's assume that. And this we would have for our class 1, and the same as we had, we would have for our class 2, yeah, also some measurements, yeah? And what we do now is we fit a Gaussian mixture model for each class. Let's assume there's some here, right? And for each class, we would now have a probability distribution, right? So what we have here is P of, yeah, well, X, which is delta D, delta theta, delta D, given that we're talking about class S plus, and we're having a set of, well, sorry, this is what we usually call the number of the set of parameters, right? In machine learning, they're also called theta, right? But that's something different. That's the angle theta, yeah? And these are the parameters theta, namely those that correspond to class plus. And here you would have the same thing for our class S minus and the respective Gaussian mixture model parameters theta minus, okay? So, and these are class conditional probabilities, right? And if you want to use them for classification, the only thing that you do is you're having a new point. Yeah. For example, this, which is also represented in the same position in two diagrams, because that's a new measurement that you have. Yeah. So you're observing a set of persons and you're observing a pair of persons, and this pair of persons has a relative interaction geometry like this. Question is the probability of that Gaussian model higher than that? Right? That's what you need to decide. If this one has a much higher probability, then you would say, okay, it's more probable that I have class S plus, right? The only thing that we need to do here is we must multiply this with the prior probability, okay, in order to be consistent, right? Because if the classes should have a very different prior probability, then it's clear that I must somehow respect that. But since we know that in our experiment we had roughly the same number of measurements in one class as in the other, we can safely neglect that. Okay? So that's what we did. And what we get is accuracies in the range of 70 to 80%, and that's quite okay. And then, as I said, we can use that with the help of weighted graphs and graph clustering to then conclude from the binary assessment to the n-ary assessment that we actually want. Okay. Now, your task is to implement the Gaussian mixture models, okay? That is something that you can forget. Okay, good. So, main things to do for this first task. We gave you this data set of delta D and delta theta values for S plus and S minus, right? And we want you to implement the expectation maximization algorithm that allows you to train this Gaussian mixture model and this Gaussian mixture model. And we would want you then to apply your results to our data set, right? So that means, as always in machine learning, you have the full data set, right? And you do what's called a cross-validation, right? So let's assume this is our data set, okay? Now, what do you do? Normally, you would say, I want to train my data on this portion, on this last portion, and then I want to check whether the model is okay on that portion, okay? Because for all of these things, you know the ground truth. You know to which class these points actually belong, right? And you use that knowledge here to train your models, and you would then check with a subset of these whether your models are good or not. That's precisely how these numbers are computed, right? So how accurate are you with your models? And it's natural that this particular choice is somehow biased. Yeah. So which part are you using for training and which part are you using for checking, right? And what you do is you would keep on rotating this, right? So this is your first run, right? In the second run, you would use this for checking and this for training and so on and so on. And always different portions. Right? And the question is, how often are you going to do this? The standard is 10-fold cross-validation. So you subdivide your training set into 10 portions, and you always use 9 of them for training and 1 for checking. And you keep on rotating this, and then afterwards you're doing the average, right? In order to compute accuracy. That's all we need to do, right? Good. So basically, it's about implementing the formula from the slides. It's not that easy because you're having to deal with convergence problems and so on, but basically it's just implementing the formula. And what I want you to learn with that is to kind of deeply understand the machine learning behind the Gaussian mixture models as an example for general machine learning. And then, which is a minor task, I want you to install Weka, which is a Java-based machine learning toolkit, very famous, all the people use it, and then try to apply three other classifiers from Weka out of the box as they are to the data set and just compare the numbers, right? So that should be, should take you like a few, very few hours to do that, right? So just install Weka, read in the data set, apply some classifiers, compare with your results, okay? You can use any math library that you want, right? So you don't need to do matrix inversion or matrix vector multiplication and so on. That you can use out of the box. But I want you to still have a non-trivial own part of the implementation left, right? So don't just use Gaussian mixture models from Weka. Apply and say that's the result, right? I want you to kind of implement the main parts, okay? And the more time restrictions you have in your group, the more chunks you can use from the library, right? So it's in a sense, it's for those groups that do not have that much time, they can then use, let's say, methods that compute the Gaussian values. Yeah, so you don't need to kind of implement that on your own. But that's more for the groups that want to excel and want to really dig into these things, right? So you have certain degrees of freedom. So if you say, okay, well, oh my God, machine learning, I don't care for this, then do it rather roughly, with rough building blocks from the math libraries, But still, the main algorithm you should implement on your own. But that's that, right? Read in the stuff, visualize it, implement EM, say, can you get the same results as we? And then you're done with the first task, okay? So do you have any questions with respect to the first task? I mean, it certainly, we would need to reconsider all the details, and I will get back to this interaction geometry things in the lecture. Presumably, for most of you, this will be a repetition then, okay? Good, cool. So second task is about face recognition, okay? And what do I mean with face recognition? Good, so let's see if I've got a slide here. Okay. Now, where do we need face recognition? So obviously you know that face recognition is a part of Facebook. So all the images that are out there are kind of processed with face detection so that you can tag the photos of your friends with their identities, right? So that's a very simple application of face recognition, or at least face detection, okay, I should say. So actually, I think that Facebook does not really do face recognition. Now, what are these two things? What's the difference, okay? So if you're having a pixel image, a scene, a photo, right? And you're having, let's say, two persons here, right? Face detection is a image processing algorithm that kind of, as it says, detects the portion of the image that contains faces, okay? And each camera, each iPhone, every device that can take photos has a face detection approach built in. So that's pretty standard. You all know how this looks like, right? And I don't want you to necessarily do the face detection step, okay? For the face detection step, you can use a toolkit that's called OpenCV, and Alex has implemented a C++ class that actually does the face detection for you. So if you want to employ that, you can deal with installing OpenCV and using Alex C++ class. In all the other cases, we require you to build your own database of faces by just manually cutting out the respective zones. Okay? That's perfectly all right if you don't want to deal with face detection, right? But that's not what we want to focus on. We want to focus on face recognition. Okay? So if you're having a lot of faces, yeah, a lot of images of faces, the question is, who are these people? Yeah? Is that George or is it Rosalie? Who are they, right? And that's just a classification problem as the one before. So what you're given is a, let's say, 100 times 100 pixel image of a face. And you can, well, these are, if these are black and white images, you would just have the value between 0 and 1 that indicates the darkness of the pixel, basically. And this is in the grid, and then you can linearize this into a 10,000 dimensional vector, okay? And these are your features. For the problem before, for the measurements of interaction geometry, we only had 2 features, yeah? But now we're having 10,000 features. And the problem is to build a classifier that kind of maps this 10,000 dimensional space to a set of classes, yeah? So let's say you're having 50 persons, and so for each image, you need to decide which of the 50 persons or which class of these 50 classes this image corresponds to, okay? Now, that's a problem, okay? Why is it a problem? Because 10,000 dimensional feature vectors are too hard for most machine learning algorithms. Why? Because of a thing that's called curse of dimensionality. Yeah. So if you ask yourself, how many training examples would I need to construct a reasonable classifier? Yeah. The thing is that this number of training examples that you need to construct a reasonable classifier does not scale linearly with the number of dimensions, but rather exponentially, right? So if we're having something exponential with an exponent of 10,000, we're lost, right? So in machine learning, we can deal with, let's say, or in typical machine learning, right? Because of that, we can deal with, let's say, 50 features or so. Yeah, that's reasonable, but not 10,000. So the basic part of our face recognition algorithm will be a pre-processing of these 10,000 dimensional face images into lower dimensional representations. And these are called eigenfaces, right? And the eigenfaces are a low dimensional representation of a face image, yeah, or are components of a low dimensional representation that kind of respect most of your face's features in an appropriate way. Okay. And the way they are composed or computed is with the help of principal component analysis. Okay. And what does that principal component analysis do? Okay. Good. Let's assume the following situation. Yeah. Once again, we're having 2 features, x1 and x2, right? And our measurements are distributed like this. Okay. So which of the features can be left out? What's your guess in that situation? If you were to drop one of the features, which one would you drop? X1 or X2? X2. Why? Yeah, that's perfectly right, right? So if you drop X2, you're not losing much because all of the values are correspond to the roughly the same X2 value, whereas all the variance is in X1. So if you're having two classes and say, well, these are examples of one class and these are examples of the other class, it's sufficient to know the X1 value, yeah, because in that region you're having this class and in that region you're having this class. X2 doesn't tell you anything about the class, right? So what we want to do is to find directions in that 10,000 dimensional space that are best discriminative for our face recognition problem, yeah? What do I mean with that? So these are directions where the variance is maximal, yeah? And the other directions where there is little variance, we can just drop because they don't tell us anything about the differences in the faces that actually count, okay? So if you were to tell me apart from him, for example, and if I told you that the current image has two eyes, one nose, and one mouth, pretty useless information, yeah? Roughly round face, useless information, yeah? Roughly bright skin color, useless information, yeah? So what is more interesting is these subtle differences in eye position, these subtle horizontal differences, length of the nose, width of the mouth, and these things, right? So the goal is to kind of find these directions in that space, and that's what principal component analysis does. So an example. Okay, let's assume, once again, two-dimensional features, and we're having this distribution of measurements, okay? Now, which feature would you drop, X1 or X2? In that case. Neither. Bingo. Right. So you can't drop any of them alone because they're both meaningful. Okay? But what you can do is you can center the image and rotate the coordinate system. Yeah. And now it's easy. Now we can apply the same logic as before. Now we can drop X2. But the new X2 is the X2 prime, right? Because what you do in that case, yeah, so if you're having measurements that are roughly have that distribution, what you do is you rotate your coordinate system, right? And that is X2 prime. And that is X1 prime. You just do a rotation and a centering, right? So the centering step is also necessary, right? Basically, it's about this rotation here, right? It allows you to say, well, in that diagonal direction, I'm having a lot of variance. But in that direction, I'm having very small variance, right? So in order to decide things, let's assume these are my faces and these are your faces, yeah? In order to distinguish them, I just need this new axis, right? This X1 prime. And I can drop X2 prime, right? That's what you do. So principal component analysis is just a orthogonal coordinate transformation, a rotation, and you would only keep the axes that have the highest variance, okay? That's all the secret in PCA. Good. Now, so such a what you do is you're building the empirical covariance matrix of your measurements, yeah, and then you do an eigenvalue decomposition, right? So eigenvalue equation, we know that matrix times vector is scalar times vector, yeah? And if you arrange the eigenvectors of an orthogonal matrix or a symmetric real matrix, let's say, if you arrange them in a matrix of their own, you can do an orthogonal coordinate transformation like that, okay? So in that new orthogonal coordinate system, the empirical covariance matrix becomes diagonal. Before, yeah, it is, you'd have the measurements, your x, these are all your phase measurements. You multiply this with itself transpose, and that's the empirical covariance matrix. If you have subtracted the center before, right? And this is the matrix you want to diagonalize. You'd have to compute the eigenvectors, and then you have the respective diagonalization. And you would drop all the x's in the order of their highest variance. Yeah? So you would take, let's say, the first 50 dimensions, okay? And you would drop out the rest 9,950 completely away, right? And that's just these things. So if you're having these faces, right, what you get from these faces is things like that, right? These are called the eigenfaces. These are also 10,000 dimensional images, yeah, but they lie in directions in that space that have high variance, right? So these strange things are what you can use to compose your actual face images out of, and these are in that directions of high variance, right? That's the basic method here, right? There's just some tricks, okay? So the trick is, okay, I'm using training images for each face, yeah? Let's say if you want to distinguish three persons, you take 10 images for each person, right? So you're having 30 images, 30 training examples. And with that, you compute your vectors to represent them, and you concatenate these images into a training set matrix X, right? So D is 10,000, right? And I'm having NP of these, where each, where the total number is, so for NP for each person, and the total number of examples would then be N, right? So N is 30, and for each person you have 10, right? So you have 30 of these images, okay? And you would arrange these pixels into such a matrix. That's our matrix X, and you would need to subtract the means from this matrix. Once you've done that, you would get this, let's call it X tilde, which is X minus the mean, okay? And X times X tilde times X tilde transposes then the empirical covariance, okay? Good. And that is the thing that you need to do the PCA on, right? And so you reduce your number of features to, let's say, 50 or 40. And with that 50 or 40, you can then do your classification, okay? And there's a trick that you need to employ. And everything is described in the background reading, right? So don't try to say, oh my God, what is he telling me? I cannot store all that information. It's all properly in the background reading. Yeah. So in Barber's book, which is free to download and so on and so on. Now, there's a trick, right? So let's assume you're having 92 times 112 pixels for your faces. So that's a 10,304 dimensional vector, okay? But you only want to use 40 eigenfaces, right? So that's, you want to drop 10,200 and something features, and you want to keep only 40 of these, okay, in a sense. What can you do? I mean, a 10,000 times 10,000 matrix is very hard to deal with. Yeah. So it's very hard to compute eigenvectors of these matrices. So there's a trick. But that's the eigenvalue equation that we start with. Okay. And, let's assume for the moment that we want to substitute not x tilde transpose, but x tilde transpose x transpose for our matrix. Then we're having this, okay? And if we multiply this from the left with x, or x tilde, I should say, then we get this expression. Now, if we say that x transpose is actually sigma, what we're having is that sigma times x times small x is lambda times small x. So the thing is, this matrix has a different dimensionality than this matrix. Okay, so you can use that trick to kind of properly do the computations, right? Because you're only dealing with very few actual dimensions, because in that 10,000 times 10,000 dimensional covariance matrix, you're only having very few eigenvalues that are non-zero, okay? And with that trick, you can actually correct for that, okay? So instead of computing this, which is high dimensional, we can compute this, and we're done, okay? So if we're having 100 images and each is of that size, our first matrix that we actually want is 10,000 times 10,000, but sigma prime that we can use instead is only 100 times 100. That's nice, okay? These are the eigenfaces and the space of these eigenfaces, right? So the directions here that are kept, right? This is called the phase space, okay? Now, if we're having a representation of our faces in that low dimensional space, we're still left with the classification task. And this we will do with the easiest classifier that you can imagine, and that's k nearest neighbors, right? So let's assume these are your processed images, these are my faces, and these are your faces, and there is a new face, right? A new image, I should say, not a new face. And the question is, does that belong to George, or does that belong to Linda, right? And what you do is you take the n nearest neighbors of that and take a majority voting, right? So if the 10 nearest patterns are all Georges, yeah, or 9 of them are Georges and only one is a Linda, then you would say, well, it's probable that this is a George, okay? So this is simple, right? And you could say, couldn't we have started from that from scratch? Why do we need all this PCA shit, yeah? Thing is, K and N doesn't work very well as all the classifiers if you're not having enough training examples. And in that 10,000 dimensional space, you would need trillions of face examples for that method to properly work. In that low dimensional eigenface approximation, you only need a very few training examples, comparatively few, right? And that's the reason why we're doing the PCA, right? Good. So that's what we do. Okay. So you must, if you have a new image, right? You must pre-process the new image in terms of PCA. Right? You must project the new image into our phase space. And in that phase space, you can then use K nearest neighbor search to determine the person or the class for the new image. That's the program you have to follow, right? So what do we need to do in task number two? So first of all, we need to build a database of face images, right? You can use that by hand. You can use one from scratch that is out there on the web. You can do whatever you want. If you want to use face detection, do so. We're providing you with respective C++ class that can do so, but you don't need to. Just get a database of faces. Understand and implement principal component analysis. Yeah. Implement K and N, which is super trivial. Yeah. And then apply and test your implementation. That's all. Right. And once again, for all these math things, you can use math libraries, but not, please, not for the PCA itself. Yeah. You can compare your implementation of PCA with the implementation from the math library, but, not just say my implementation of task number two consists of a one line code. Yeah. Use math library and eigenfaces to, that's not what we want. Yeah. Nevertheless, the implementation is comparatively small. If you use math libraries for matrix multiplication, eigenvector calculation, and all these things, yeah, which please you should do, then it should be a few lines of code. Yeah. Not very much. That's not actually a big task. And so, these are two things. Yeah. So interaction geometry classifiers with GMM and face recognition with eigenfaces and K and N. Okay. And the third thing is, please, we have a description of that creativity software that you can use online, which was provided by us, by that company, which was founded by members, former members of our group. And then for, let's say, 1 or 2 hours, stick together in the group and try to come up with ideas of how you can use face recognition and these social situation detection methods in games, right? We made a few suggestions for you to start with, and maybe you can build on them. Maybe you can have completely new ideas. And what we only want you to do is use the software to develop ideas and then just export them. Do not program anything. Yeah. So what you can do is you can split up your group, let's say in subgroups of three, and one subgroup does the geometry thing and the other subgroup does the face thing, right? That's one solution, okay, to deal with the complexity. But really, it's not a big task. It's a rather complicated task with respect to math, but I gave you proper background readings and you should be able to understand. If you're having severe difficulties, for example, with that face recognition stuff, with the eigenfaces stuff, I would be happy to give you an extra lesson on the details if you really want. Yeah. I would explain to you what is principal component analysis in every detail. I would explain, yeah, all the stuff you need, but only if you want. It's all in the background readings, and the original idea of the task or the assignment is that you try to understand that on your own, right? So it's like 3-4 pages in Barber's book. Yeah. There he describes what PCA is. I linked you to the original paper where the eigenfaces were proposed, describing everything. You have the slides. You should be able to deal with these things. Yeah. If you're having difficulties, and that's also for the ones listening to the recording, please indicate that to me, and we can have an extra session where I explain the backgrounds, right? But basically, it's just get an understanding and implement it. It's not really much. Yeah. And I think the learning effect is quite, substantial. Because if you did that, you basically have the full program or a substantial part of the machine learning program. You know what a generative classifier is, you know what expectation maximization is, and you know what feature reduction is. And the rest out there in machine learning is variance, I should say. Yeah. So neural networks and all these things, that these are just other ways to do classification. Yeah. But basically, you'd have it. We know what clustering is. We then know what classification is. You're having a machine learning experience for free, in a sense. And that's what I want you to have, because social computing is so much about machine learning these days. Yeah? So you just cannot ignore that. And that's why I want you to have that. Cool, perfect. Any questions? I just machine gunned you down with all this, right? Once again, I mean, after each lecture, you can come down and ask me, right? If you don't want to have a central session, come down, ask me, what was that? Why is that in transpose? And why is that with the dimensions? I don't get it. I will explain everything, right? Cool. So see you then next week on Tuesday, right?